It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? I'm Paul Spitero, and as always, sitting diagonally in the Brady Bunch frame that is on my computer screen is Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here.
It is a pleasure to be here with you. And today we have Mr. Scott Gardner.
Hello! Thanks for having me back.
I understand the check is in the mail, so we're always willing to just, pimp ourselves out for the right cash outlay. And a long-awaited return for Mr. Chris Keith, who hasn't been on this show in, I think the last time you were on was when we did Bohemian Rhapsody.
We did Rocket Man, and then we tried to do My Cousin Vinny, and I think something got screwed up. It was you, me, and yeah. I can't remember the other guy that was with
Dave
us.
Dave Pastorella.
That was going to be the
All Lawyers episode.
The All Lawyers episode.
A law movie.
That was a lot of fun. That was a blast. And then I will say that, it's funny. I was telling my wife, revising, going back and looking at some of the stuff, years later, you realize, wow, I really thought Bohemian Rhapsody was that good back then. And now I watch it, and I'm like, yeah, it's all right. So, yeah, hindsight is I think I'll watch Fantastic Four, the new one, and then take a couple of minutes and actually think for a change before I render a decision.
I remember liking Bohemian. I don't even remember what ratings we gave it, but I remember liking it a lot initially, and I've had zero desire to rewatch it since. I think I know we're going far afield here, but I think my being enamored with that movie was mostly based on them recreating Queen concerts and how they, the attention to detail that they had for it, and I think that was what really carried it. In a similar way to the movie Titanic, where the actual backstory of the movie is of no interest to me, but the way they recreate the ship and all the different things on it, I found fascinating. So that has zero to do with what we're here for today. Today we are taking a look, and I'm going to give a little backstory on that. Sean and I have been trying to hit on some of the older superhero movies. We did Superman versus the Mole Man a while back, and actually we've already recorded, but it's going to probably come out after this, maybe, I'm not sure. But we did the 1990 Captain America movie, and today we are looking at the 1994 unreleased Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie. And I find this to be fascinating. I thought I had seen this, but I think I just saw clips from it until we were prepping for the show today. And then I watched it on YouTube because it is available there. And I watched it, you know, a second time for the sake of the show. But these are the first times I've watched it all the way through. So I guess my opinion coming into that prep was more based upon what I had heard about it as opposed to what I actually experienced with it. And I'll keep what I experienced with it to myself for now until we all have a chance to just give our initial experiences with this film. Sean, had you ever seen this before we were prepping?
No, it was really the prep for this, and you bringing it up as far as part of this film series that we're doing was what drew me to it. I'd seen images of it, and maybe a clip here and there, but nothing that was of any substance to it. So this was actually my first, well, second viewing now of this film.
Okay, how about Scott? When did you first experience the greatness that is Roger Corman?
I have been racking my brain to try to remember when I could have possibly have first seen this. And I was, for the longest time, I was thinking, oh, it had to be, you know, when I was living with Chris Honeywell in Rochester for a brief time. But that can't be right because I moved to Georgia in late 93 and this movie is 94 and didn't start showing up, you know, to where you could watch, even though it was never released, you know, very shortly after they finished it, it started like popping up at like conventions and stuff, you know, bootlegs. So I don't remember. I think I know that when I first saw it, and for the longest time, whenever I would watch it, it was off of like a really shitty VHS, like zillionth generation bootleg, you know, where it was really hard to, like, you had to really want to watch it because the quality was just awful. So I'm thinking I either bought it at a convention, you know, as a bootleg, or maybe traded with somebody, because I used to have a lot of, you know, the bootlegs that weren't available. Like, you know, I had like the KCOP version of Superman, the movie, and I had the international cuts of Superman 2 and 3 and, just weird stuff like that. So I might've traded somebody for, I can't remember, but anyway, it was on VHS. And, you know, despite the low quality of the, you know, the videotape and all that, and the low quality of the movie, as far as, you know, the budgetary restrictions and all, I've always had kind of a soft spot for this one. And, a lot of, I think a lot of it is due to its underdog status. And also just the earnestness behind it, kind of thing, but I'll save the rest of my comments for as we get deeper into it. But yeah, I saw this one. It had to be not long after it started popping up on the convention circuit, because I can remember being, you know, aware of when knowledge started to get out there about it. And people started talking about it on, you know, like the chat groups and stuff like that. And I remember being, you know, a part of some of that stuff. So I'm thinking 95, 96, something like that.
All right. How about you, Chris?
For this, I think the only time I ever saw, I want to say I saw, kind of like you said, Scott, a bootleg at, I think, Dallas Comic Con, but that was about 10 years ago. And I was more preoccupied with, I think, trying to buy a vintage Star Trek II Wrath of Khan poster instead. So it preoccupied my interest more. So I don't know. Looking at it, everything I'd read about it just, you know, sounded like it was low rent. So I'm like, eh. Maybe I'll think about it. But it, I mean, once this came up, I was like, yeah, it's finally an opportunity to watch this thing. So.
Sometimes this show gives me an excuse to watch a movie that I otherwise would not make the time to watch. And to be fair, more often than not, I find that to be rewarding. More often than not, I'm glad I got a chance to watch even some movies that I really end up giving a poor rating to. I still am happy to cross them off the list of movies that I have not seen. So now, as far as this goes, in addition to the movie, there's a documentary that's on Amazon Prime called Doomed, which is the backstory of this movie. And I'm pretty sure all four of us have watched that at this point too. The legend behind this movie is pretty well known, that it was produced on a very low budget by Corman in a very short period of time, for the sake of preserving the rights, but that all the creative people involved in it, the actors, the director, casting director, the special effects people, for what they are, they were all thought they were making a big screen movie that was going to be released. And clearly from the documentary, seeing interviews with these people, they were all extremely disappointed that it didn't happen, because even though they knew this was a very low budget movie and that the production values weren't going to be all that high, they thought it could be the stepping stone to greater things, in that it would give them significant exposure. And we'll talk about the actors that were in this as we go on. But I find that whole story to be interesting. And I'm sure, like I said, I think it's well known by most people.
Now, even though you guys are just now seeing it for this recording, were any of you following the production of the movie as it was coming along? Because I'd kind of forgotten until watching the documentary that, yeah, I think it was Comic Scene or one of those old fanzines. I remember following the development of it and thinking, oh, this looks really good, and being really interested in it. And then it just never happened. But that was kind of common back around that time, because I remember the same sort of thing happened with like Return of the Swamp Thing and Fright Night 2, both movies I was really anticipating and kind of following the development of. And then they just like disappeared. And but at least with those movies, they eventually wound up on, actual releases of, videotape releases by the companies that produced them, unlike this that just got buried.
In that era, we knew a lot less than we do now. I mean, our accessibility to what's going on behind the scenes. And I was following it exactly like you're talking about, but it was not like you're saying, it was not uncommon for films to drop off the radar. One thing I want to say before we go on, and I don't want to cut anybody off here, but we mentioned the documentary. I would suggest highly, if you have not watched the documentary and you've watched this movie, you have to watch the documentary.
Yeah.
A lot of my feelings today, I'm just going to, full disclosure, are very driven by the combination of the two. And I feel like the documentary is essential viewing to watch this film.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that.
Well, we've talked, in particular, when Sean and I talked about the 1990 Captain America movie, we discussed the fact that you kind of have to take into account the era that the movie was made. And the level of filmmaking at that time, as compared to now, when things are so much more sophisticated. So you kind of have to give some leeway on that. And then when you take into account that this one, again, was made I'm pretty sure the budget was $1.4 million, which was, which is a pittance in the movie making world, even in 1994. So you have to factor that in. If you're watching it to be awed by spectacle, this isn't the movie to watch. If you're watching it to see the story and the... What I'm going to say is fairly good acting for the most part. Mm-hmm. It's worth seeing, if nothing else, just as an oddity. And I think there's something to be said for that. I would love to see, with this current day and age, before we started recording, we were talking about AI and the plethora of it out there. And with the easy availability of AI combined with a lot of filmmaker wannabe people who will do their own cuts and edits of things, I would love to see some enterprising young person take this cut that's available, which has been stepped on a million times, and clean it up and clean up the special effects and just take it and make it into a presentable film. And I think Marvel would benefit to some extent if they did that and then put it as a special feature on Fantastic Four First Steps when it comes out on physical media. In the current day and age, physical media seems to be dying off a little bit. So if you want the people to buy them, you got to give them a little something extra that they might not get otherwise. And I think throwing a cleaned up version of this on that DVD or Blu-ray or whatever form they have, you know, even if you're buying it through Apple Music and playing it on there, but if you get that as an extra, I think it would make you want to buy it more.
Well, you know, granted that documentary is a few years old now, but, you know, as of the making of that documentary, you know, the director's still alive and several of the people, you know, involved with, you know, actually producing the film, you know, not just the actors, but, you know, the folk, you know, I forget now whether it was the writer, but, you know, the editor and that sort of thing. You know, along with what you said, not so much a fan edit, but, you know, do kind of the Star Trek, the motion picture thing. You know, they famously had Robert Wise go back in and, you know, they did the director's edition of Star Trek where they cleaned it up and enhanced the effects and kind of updated the movie, but made it more in line with his original vision for the film that was never realized because of, you know, a lot of factors. They could do something similar with this, and I wouldn't think it would be, with modern technology and everything, it shouldn't be terribly expensive. It's not like they'd be doing reshoots or anything. They'd just be, what you said, you know, cleaning up the effects and maybe tightening up the editing. And I think this movie could really benefit by some sound play, you know, redesign and you know, clean up this, because some of the sound's really muddy, that sort of thing. But yeah, I'd love to see it get some treatment like that. And it's my understanding that the actor that played Doom has really been pushing hard in recent years to get the film out there, you know, to get it with an official release. So, you know, I think couple the two together, you know, an official release, but an official release that, you know, brings the film more in line with what the filmmakers intended. Because, yeah, it is a shame.
So I guess we could start with the story. Not even the story. The story, you know, I'm going to give the story credit for being very true to the Fantastic Four for the most part. The one thing about the story that I don't like at all is the jeweler, because we didn't have the rights to the Mole Man at the time. It was clearly supposed to be the Mole Man, and they didn't have the rights for whatever reason, so it had to get played with, and they had to create another character. I don't see any reason, if we followed through on our thought about, you know, kind of cleaning it up and redoing it, I don't see any reason, because they do have the rights to the Mole Man now, as far as I know. I don't believe there's any problem with that. And I'm pretty sure virtually all the actors are still alive. Possibly, I don't know about the jeweler, but I don't see any reason why they couldn't even play with the script, make some changes here and there, you know, tweak it a little bit, and then get new audio to kind of dub in to create the, you know, the just a slightly better script, because I think some of the dialogue is a little clunky. I think the story is good, but I think some of the dialogue is a little clunky. I think, again, you could turn it into the Mole Man. You could use some special effects to turn the jeweler's henchmen into moloids. You know, you could definitely have some fun with this. And again, with the way AI is now, I don't even think it would cost, I don't think it would require them to add a very high budget onto it to do it.
I would also argue that you should get rid of that emotional part. Like, their powers came from the emotional part. That's a personal preference for me. I don't know why it was necessary. And
Sue, you're embarrassed and shy. Yeah. So that's why you get invisible. Yeah. That's like, yeah. So beating you over the head with it.
Yeah, Ben, you must be just preference. Angry as hell because we're going to make you this giant rock monster. That made a whole heck of a lot of sense. Yeah.
And, well, the thing that doesn't make sense in that, I'm sorry, Scott.
Doesn't some of that have a root in the comics, though?
I don't care that there's some comic book basis to it. I just think the way they did it in the movie was clunky. Yes.
I got you. Okay, yeah.
I would especially totally especially they say, well, how come each of us turn back to normal when we're not using our powers, but the thing doesn't? I don't know. it's like, well, at least give us a viable answer to that one if you're going to pose the question.
Again, though, playing devil's advocate, I think that comes from the comics, though, because I seem to recall that being asked in one of the early stories. Like, I could be wrong, and maybe I'm confusing it with the movie, because now that I think about it, I think there's a scene with Chris Evans as the Human Torch in one of his movies asking Reed, like, how come I can turn it on, or we can turn it on and off, and he can't? So maybe I'm thinking of that and not necessarily the comics. But.
And then they did seem to add in the thought that he can, because there's the scene when he turns back into Ben Grimm, right, until he needs to be the Thing, and then he turns back into the Thing.
Right.
And they don't really give you any comic book explanation for why that occurred.
Right.
And I totally agree with the concept here of, I don't know so much that I needed it gone as much as I just didn't like the execution. So that it's not like one of those, like, if they put it in and just there was something about the execution. I feel like it was not necessary in how they used it. And I really didn't like what they did with the Thing with it. I'll openly say that. I to me, it's like, so now all of a sudden, if he like calms down, or, you know, he's in love, he can become human again. I'm like, oh, but that takes away the whole crusk of the Ben Grimm story that I like. It's the fact that he stays that way and Alicia loves him anyway.
the comment that I wrote down while I was watching, and I watched it again yesterday, but I was like, the Thingier, I'm sorry, the angrier he gets, the Thingier he gets. So it's basically like he ripped off the Hulk without realizing it, because there's no way these writers had ever read a Hulk comic book.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. They also let him say it's clobbering time 3 times. I thought that was 2 times too many.
Well, the first time they had a gun. I don't know if it was Doom or if it was one of his minions, but somebody had a gun to Alicia's head. I'm like, maybe clobbering time's not the right phrase at this point when he's got a gun. Okay, pop. Oh, I made a huge mistake. Yeah, it's
blow your brains out time. Yeah, no, I think the script could be doctored a little bit. And I think, like I said, if they were going to go through with my plan, I still think you could do it with the footage you have. I don't think you have to lay it. You don't have to put a lot of budget into it to do that. You would definitely need to do some alternate dialogue and soundtrack. Like you said, Scott, you want to clean up the soundtrack anyway. So,
right.
And I think, do you remember, like, when you'd watch a TV show in, say, the 80s, and there was a curse, but they had to, like, dub over it? And it was always like, if you were listening, it was really, really obvious that the word, whatever word they stuck in there, was put in later.
Right.
Because the whole sentence is the same except for that one word. I think with computers being what they are now, they could have that blend seamlessly.
Right.
You know, the lip sync might not be exactly right, but I think with AI, you could probably even fix that.
Probably. They'd get Jackie Gleason to make it actually look like he's saying scumbum instead of some bitch. That'd be interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly the type of thing I'm talking about. Yeah. I'm thinking of in The Godfather, when Sonny's on the phone and says, I don't want my brother coming out of that bathroom with nothing but his stick in his hand. Yeah, that's not what Sonny said. So, like I said, I think the script of, or the story again, I think is pretty true, and it can be cleaned up, and I think it could be very, very serviceable. I think, again, the dialogue needs to be doctored a little bit and changed. And I think if you were going to try and upgrade this thing, you would add to the special effects. I happen to actually get a big kick out of the very cartoony Human Torch at the end. But to me, that almost reminded me of the Fleischer Superman cartoons.
Exactly.
It's funny you say that, because I would love to see a side-by-side comparison, because as I was watching this and my son Logan was watching it with me, there's a part where when Johnny gets in front of the beam and gets hit by the beam and he kind of tumbles, and then he turns around and he's actually fighting the beam and blasting at it and everything. I could swear that they ripped off the animation from the Fleischer cartoon. I forget the name of the one. I think it might just be Superman. I think it's the first one with where the scientist is shooting the electrothanasia ray at the city, and Superman like flies in front of the thing and gets hit. I think it's the exact same animation. I really do think they ripped it off. But then again, I mean, that stuff was public domain by that point. So, you know,
it would be a legal ripoff.
Yeah. I mean, that was the big special effects moment of the picture. And I remember at the time thinking it was pretty good and, you know, that it held up pretty well. Now, you know, today it looks terribly dated and all. But it's funny, even at the time thinking that, because by the point where this movie was out, you know, we had things like Jurassic Park. So it didn't even really look good compared to its contemporaries. But
well, that's not really fair, though. I mean, Jurassic Park was a very big budget.
Right, right.
Cutting edge special effects movie at the time. You know, the budget of this movie probably wouldn't have covered one of the animatronics that they used in Jurassic Park.
Right. But it's odd to me that at the time it didn't really seem to stand out. You know, like I remember thinking, oh, that's really cool. Like that was the cool moment of the movie, you know, special effects wise was the whole Human Torch thing. But watching it now, it's like, okay, I can see the bones of a really cool sequence, but wow, is it, you know, badly dated, you know, because now it looks like a cut scene from an old Tomb Raider game or something like that. You know what I mean? It's pretty rough.
I appreciated the attempt, though.
Right.
I
mean,
because I feel like what, especially knowing the story of the film, it's what a documentary I do think is essential. When you know what like their budget was, to Paul's point, and what they were trying to do here, I'm like, okay, they recognized that moment needed pop. And they did everything they could with the budget they had to deliver pop. And it does stand out when you take a look at the special effects through the rest of the film. It stands out as being a moment in the appropriate way.
Right.
Well, the you know, one of the sequences I think could easily be improved upon is, you know, they did what they could for Reed Richards stretching, you know, which was mostly, you know, a glove on a stick. Mm-hmm. But like in the scene when he's fighting Doom and he just starts throwing punches. Yeah. Oh, then the hand coming up out of the limousine. Yes.
Yeah.
But when he throws a punch that looks like it has absolutely no momentum behind it. And he's punching somebody theoretically who's in a metal mask. Why is that going to hurt Doom in any way, shape, or form? I don't know. So I think that's something that could be improved upon easily. You know, but again, it's there's something about it's almost like, you know, it's like it's watching almost like an amateur movie. Mm-hmm. and giving it, you know, the props for that. Again, I want to bring us back to, though, the fact that this cast is actually fairly good.
Yes.
I'm just going to, you know, quickly go over the main five. Actually, the main five, I think, Ben is the one who doesn't really have much of a career in movies, but Reed and Sue were both soap opera actors, and you know, and had an extensive career. And the actor who plays Reed, his father was an actor. Johnny was a child Disney movie actor, so he has had a long history. And Doom is Robert Culp's son, so yeah. He was, you know, involved in the industry for years and years. So,
well, you know,
these are people. Sorry,
I said, you know who Johnny is, right? You remember Bug from Uncle Buck?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't recognize him for about the first 10 minutes. And then I have to look at him and I was like, wow, you ever hear of a ritual killing? And yeah, anyway.
Love that guy, really.
He was the boy who could fly. I remembered him. He was the sort of boyfriend for Annabelle Gish in Desert Bloom, which played on HBO like constantly when I was a kid. But there was that scene at the end, you know, toward the end of the movie where she's running away from home and he goes along with her and they run out into the desert. where they were going to test the A-bomb. I always remembered that. So I remember when I watched this for the first time, you know, and now he's, you know, by that point he was in his 20s or whatever, and just watching him through the whole movie going, who the hell, I know this guy, and driving me crazy until I finally realized who he was, you know. But he was
in the really...
I was just gonna say he was the only one that I really knew.
You know, well, the I saw in the documentary, I watched it yesterday, and I'd forgotten that the stuntman who ended up playing the Thing, because for whatever reason, when they put him in the costume, they had a different actor, and it was the stuntman. That's the guy that Joe Pesci put his head in a vice in Casino. And my wife and I just watched it the other night. So I was like, wow, it's that guy. That's his only, the only reason I would know him is that poor slob had an eye pop out.
Alex Hyde-White, who played Reed Richards, I actually think was probably one of the better big screen Reed Richards. Sad that he didn't get there. I just haven't thought that Reed Richards has been really done well on the screen. The only issue with him is special effects. I agree with the comments earlier. Even the part where he saved Sue, like, it looked creepy. Just the way, which is not what you're going for. It just the hand reaching out. I will say I did like the escape bit where the foot sneaking under, you know, like Doom wouldn't have accounted for that. I thought that was actually a clever use of it. And at that point, I think I'd gotten out of the way of, okay, I'm going to have issues with the way that it's used. But I felt like that sequence worked for me with him. But I liked him. Which Reed on screen just does not translate usually into a like. And I love Reed Richards. I want to be very, very clear off of that. Comic book wise, I love the character. I just don't think he's translated very well to big screen. And I felt like I actually liked Alex Hyde-White's portrayal of him. Overall, there's some dialogue issues in this film, which goes back to, I actually want to talk about Joseph Culp. Because I like him as Doom. But they make some Batman and Robin level slapstick mistakes with him where it's like he's heading down a path where it's like everything's going well. And then you're like, no, don't say that. Not here. It's like a joke is thrown in out of nowhere. It's like you've got a menacing Doom. You're like, okay, right now, just stop. Don't say another word. And yet they do. And it was multiple scenes where it's like, we've got to drop that line. And it's like, what film are you doing here? And I don't feel it the same way that I do in Batman and Robin. So I want to be clear. Let me distinguish between the two films right now. But it is a mistake that film made quite often where it like had an identity crisis. And I feel like when those moments hit, it's like, you're forgetting what film you're making here. And that's what happened with those Doom sequences. And that's not the actor's fault. That was a poor dialogue choice in the writing. I think we lost what we were trying to do storytelling wise with the character at that point.
You know, Andy Leyland for years has been bagging on Julian McMahon from the two Fantastic Four movies in the 2000s for basically just being Julian McMahon and being smarmy. And I let me preface this by saying I can't stand Dr. Doom. I've always hated that character. The boisterous, overly loud, it always wore me out. There was finally, I think when Simonson was writing it in the 80s, there was finally a moment where Reed went up against him one-on-one and finally just beat his dumb ass and admitted, it's like, finally, look, you're second best, just deal with it. And it's like, finally, thank you. And of course, you know, it didn't matter, he still came back 5 minutes later. But yeah, like you're saying, that guy, there were a couple, and I noted it, there were a couple of instances with Victor where I said he's too passive, he's got jazz hands. There were a few times, yeah, and then some of that dialogue with the jazz hands was a little ridiculous. And then he a few times he was pulling either his kind of a weak Jack Nicholson impression of the Joker, just a few instances, and that, and it didn't help that he fell off the building at the end, but that a couple of times, like, I don't know exactly if this guy's figured out his motivation for this character, because it was kind of all over the place.
See, I liked him a lot as Victor.
Yes.
But once he was actually in the costume, it's like he just went off the rails with his performance, and he's just hamming it way too much. And what's with the fingers? He's constantly clicking and it's like a person that's constantly cracking their knuckles. It was really irritating. And, you know, the constant click, 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 click sound of him playing with his fingers in the armor. I'm just like, what is this? Is this supposed to be your thing? because it's just annoying. So yeah. I mean, I like the movie a lot, and I give it a lot of leeway because I respect what they were going for and what they accomplished for what they had to work with. You know, ever since becoming aware of the term, you know, verisimilitude, thanks to Richard Donner and Superman the movie, any movie, you know, comic book movie that really uses that well, I'll give them a lot of leeway. And so I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for the earnestness and verisimilitude of the actors, most of them, with this movie and for what they did. But that's not to say it doesn't have some problems. And I think the biggest problem is that villain-wise, I think they could really have used to dial Doom way back, plus just concentrate on just him. I think throwing in the whole jeweler thing just kind of muddied the waters. And I could never get a handle on the jeweler because I'm like, okay, is this supposed to be the Mole Man or is this supposed to be the Puppet Master? And I think he was supposed to be a little bit of both. And then the other thing that the big negative for me is Alicia. I'm fine with if they wanted to just introduce her, but I mean, they go the full gamut. I mean, they meet and then like the very next scene, she does that, Ben, I love you. And I'm like, you just met the guy. It was, I mean, that was the one like super cringe moment of the movie for me. I'm like, okay, you know, too fast, too quick. And she was the weak link in the acting armor in this movie. Everybody else I thought was pretty good. Although again, I didn't really care for the jeweler, but Alicia, she was bad. She was terrible.
And just to give a bad joke with Alicia, you can't even say it was love at first sight.
I might be able to top you on the creep factor because there's one other scene that I had an issue with. No,
I'll get to that.
In Mrs. Storm's school, and this maybe we might go into the same spot. Reed and Sue, and the fact that she was this little girl who had a crush on him.
It's from the comics.
But I don't think the age difference was supposed to be quite as pronounced when they first met. You know, the older you get, the less that age difference means. Mm-hmm. And I don't think she was supposed to be 10 when they met.
Funny you mentioned 10 because I was watching it and I said it's about as creepy. You know what it totally reminded me of? Have you ever heard the story about Mick Jagger and Mackenzie Phillips? Apparently at Mackenzie Phillips.
No, but I'm
Phillips,
afraid 18th, I'm going to now.
Yeah, you're going to hear this. At her 18th birthday, I guess she went downstairs to the basement to go get something out of the basement, and Mick follows her and then locks the door and basically just says, I've been waiting for you, baby, since you were 10 years old. So you got John Phillips outside while, So that's just gross. Wow. I know in the comics there was that age difference, but I don't recall her. Even still, it's, when you see it with actual actors, it's like, wow, that – in no way, shape, or form it's just gross. It just creeped me out.
Yeah, I agree. That was something that I was conscious of when I was watching it, that the age difference, again, the older you get, the less the age difference means. If he's 30 and she's 20, that age difference isn't so bad. If he's 20 and she's 10, yeah, that age difference is bad now. So, you know, if it was... they met and he was 28 and she was 18 and, you know, he was hesitant because of the age difference. And then they got a little older and, you know, Reed is supposed to be older. He's got the white temples. So, you know, he could at least be in his mid to late 30s at least. So she could be 10 years younger than him and it'll be fine. But again, it's when that happens, you know, if he's 12 and she's 2, also not good. You know, that same number makes a difference. The younger you are, the more it makes a difference.
When they encounter each other when they're older, when we flash back to that scene, I actually did like the chemistry between the actress who played the older Sue and Reed. I was buying into that. I liked their journey. It's actually, we're talking about how the Ben and Alicia journey didn't seem to have enough breathing room, but I actually felt in this, because of the fact that they had so much screen time together, I felt like the Reed and Sue journey actually did have a lot of breathing room. Right. And that part actually worked for me. It was the before then. I think it was just the age of the actress. It just, that part kind of creeped me out a little bit. But
you know what?
Not enough to ruin the other stuff, though.
You know what makes that work for me? If you can, and again, you could play with the script a little bit. Don't have them be living in the same house where they're going to know each other so well. Mm-hmm. Have her have a crush on him from afar, and he doesn't even know who she is. And by the time he knows who she is, she's an adult. Mm-hmm. Then it's not so creepy. But the fact that he knew her since she was a little girl, you know, that adds the creep factor.
In that scene, though, with her as a little girl, though, correct me if I'm wrong, she's kind of infatuated with him, but does he show any romantic interest in her?
No.
No, but he still knows her.
Right.
He still knows
her
since she's a little kid. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, I don't know, it just doesn't sit right. Like I said, if he really kind of didn't even know she was alive, even though she was crushing on him, I can go with that. You know, the creep factor is from his side, not from hers.
Scott, you're right, though. I didn't get the impression that in those early sequences with them that he was showing that kind of interest in her.
Right.
He was very caught up at that time on his experiments, what he was working on, those type of pieces, and he and Ben were having those conversations together. It was very clear she was crushing on him, but it was not. I actually would probably have a bigger issue with it if I was seeing the two-way interchange.
Right.
And I would not have been so cool with when they're older that like that seemed to be the blooming of an actual relationship.
Right.
But even, you know, they went to the effort to have the, you know, Johnny and Sue's mother, who's not in the comics, you know, be like, oh, look at them, the Fantastic Four. Like they were all so close to each other, which then undermines my theory of, you know, Reed doesn't even know she's alive. So I did not like that aspect of the script. Again, I'm going to keep most of my shots are going to be leveled towards the script, I think, even more so than the special effects, because what do you expect them to do with, you know, a couple of rubber bands and a matchbook?
They also had no leeway to make adjustments.
No, because they had to get it done.
Really, where when you take a look at it, and Scott, you've mentioned this more than once, that there's a lot to love about this film because of what they accomplished with it. It's when you look behind the scenes, if they wanted to do redos of scenes or rewrites of scenes and things like that, because like, hey, as we were shooting this, it kind of isn't working out the way you want to. They did not have that luxury at all to make any considerations or adjustments for this thing. The documentary really is a critical.
Well, the script was written in 6 days, and the shooting schedule was 21 days.
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah.
And the joking scene that comes to mind for me is in the cartoon, The Flintstones. There's an episode where Fred gets a role as a movie extra and they're doing a low budget movie. And it's like, okay, you're going to be here and there's all these boulders coming down on you. And the director says, do we have the fake boulders? And the guy says, do you know how much fake boulders cost? All right, just use the real boulders then. And they drop all these things on him. And that's what this movie feels like to some extent when it comes to the special effects. They said Doom's lasers were done with colored pencils on the film. They drew them in. So, wow. I mean, you know, that's as low budget as you're going to get on that.
Now, they used to do it back in the day, though.
I think they used to do it with, you know, enough time to actually try and, you know, make it look a little cleaner. But again, you know, I'm not trying to rag on what they did. When, you know, when we talk about, you know, the Reed effect being a little cheesy, or the, you know, the Human Torch being an animation or whatever. I think they made the most of the $1.4 million they had. It's just, you know, that wasn't enough money to make a really presentable film at that time. But again, I think the earnestness of the director and the cast comes through and makes it, Like, I could understand where they might have thought, you know, this is going to get a big screen release and it's going to be, you know, pretty popular. I have this image in my mind that 99 times out of 100, even the shittiest movies that you see, when they're making them, the cast and the director thinks, I'm getting an Academy Award for this one. You know, I think that they just, you know, they really put their, you know, for the most part, put their best effort out there. And I've seen some actors talking, and I think recently, you know, we did Batman and Robin on here, and like George Clooney was talking, and he said something to the effect of, you know, while we were filming it, we thought it was good, you know, but then when you see the final cuts, you're like, oh, it's not what I thought. So I do think there's that aspect to this that you know, you're doing your best and you think you're doing well, and then when you see it, it doesn't quite translate to what you wanted. And from what I understand, on the set of this, they didn't have monitors to see exactly how it looked. You know, there's a lot of little touches that took away from their ability to put this out as well as they could. Now, I'm going to move off the cast a little bit, and I'm going to touch on, I thought, considering this movie and what it is, I thought the score was actually pretty decent. Yeah. And I'm curious to see what Scott, my score expert, thought about this one.
I tell you, you know, I over the years of being a film score collector, I have had a number of holy grails, and this was one of my holy grails for a long, long time. And I can't tell you how thrilled I was to finally find this. It's really neat. At the end of the documentary, the documentary, by the way, is called Doomed. I'm not sure if we mentioned that before. But at the end of the documentary, as you know, the credits are rolling and everything, right toward the very end of the credits, I thought it was really neat that they listed all of the names of the pieces of music that they used for the documentary. Every one of those pieces of music is a track from the official release of the soundtrack. So the soundtrack to this movie didn't get its own individual release, but all the tracks are on an album called Music for Film. It was released in 1998, and it's by David and Eric Wurst. And so it has 7 tracks from the Fantastic Four film, and then the other 9 tracks on it are just other pieces of work that they have done for other film and TV projects. Some of them are pretty decent, some of them are not so great. But the actual 7 tracks of the Fantastic Four film, every single track is really, really good. And considering, again, the short time they had to work with, and just, you know, the budget and every, you know, all the factors of this, that they produced such a really good score is kind of shocking. And I'll tell you, I really enjoyed the score. I was actually listening to it just before we started the recording. I play this one in pretty heavy rotation. I like this one a lot. I liked it so much that way back in the day when we were doing a show called Tales of the Justice Society of America, in the early episodes, we were using the Fantastic Four theme as the theme for that podcast because we figured nobody knew it. You know, nobody would actually remember what the music was and know what it was. And we just wanted to use something that was, you know, just kind of generically superhero. And right from the very first time I ever saw this movie, that was always the thing that really struck me right out of the gate, because the movie starts with you know, with the credits and with the space scene, and the theme slowly builds to the big reveal and plays the theme. And right from the very first viewing, I thought, hey, I really like this theme. It's very good. It's I don't know. It hits all the beats, and the composers did the thing that I like the best, you know, kind of taking from the John Williams school of this sort of thing of having distinct themes. So the team has its own theme. Victor has a theme. There's a villain march that is really heavily ripping off the march of the villains from Superman, the movie, but also giving it its own spin. There's kind of a fight theme and a love theme. So, you know, all these different themes playing through the whole soundtrack. And yeah, I think honestly, beyond the earnestness of most of the cast and the performances of most of the cast, I think the biggest positive coming out of this movie is actually the soundtrack. It's a really good score.
None of the tracks do I dislike. The only issue I have goes back to, and I, by the way, I want to be very clear to people listening to this. I like this movie. The pieces that I'm seemingly nitpicking are pieces that took me away tonally from what I was enjoying.
Right.
And there's a sequence with the two thugs of Dooms where they're going to see our jeweler, who was our mole man guy. And they had a sequence where all of a sudden, even tonally, the music is getting very, very silly, very, very slapstick. And yep. It led me back to that Batman and Robin thing. I actually agree with you. I really like the score in this film. Actually, the song that was playing, I like the song in isolation. I don't like it for the sequence because it's taking something where, I don't know, we had some danger going on here. How about tonally keeping and owning that? Right. It's right. I think where the film had an issue is this film is complete, yes. But I feel like it was rushed complete, whereas like you can put a period that it's complete versus an exclamation point that it's complete. If they had had the time that they thought they were going to have, and I mean, this was still a compressed timeline, without the additional drama that they were facing along the way of even trying to keep this thing afloat long enough to get where they did, I would love to have seen if they were able to edit this a bit. And what they would have maybe achieved. And that's where the soundtrack, it's not that I don't like the soundtrack. It's a sequence like that where I'm getting that, and that music is playing over a sequence that I think that's what they were shooting for tonally. It's like, no, why are you doing this to this film? And I think I feel passionately about that because of the fact that there's so much about this that I like. And I feel it's the inconsistencies in the tone are where I feel like you guys are onto something here. And with what they were doing, I think that part's remarkable.
I agree. Yeah.
You know, I like the main theme. I like the flourishes in it. And you mentioned the Justice Society. And I was like, that's right. That's where I've heard this before from back in the day. But some of the rest of it, I don't know, just to me, it just felt... kind of Knots Landing-ish. I don't know. It felt like an evening, like a dynasty, something that not the main theme, but something that as the car is pulling into the driveway, just something about it. Just, I don't know. Maybe it's just my personal preference, but as listening to it, I kept thinking, yeah, I'm waiting for Valene to get home to Gary. And then they're going to talk about what's going on at South Fork.
You know, not for nothing, but Dynasty had an awesome theme song, but whatever.
Did have a great theme song.
Anything else about this that stood out to you guys that needs to be gone over?
I Sean was talking about Reed Richards and the actor that played him. I like him a lot as Reed. I don't know that he would be my favorite Reed necessarily. I think he could have been a little more decisive and a little more take charge. But then again, you know, this is the early days, you know, the beginnings of the Fantastic Four. So I still kind of lean towards Ian Grafod or however the hell you pronounce that guy.
Ian Grofeld. I think he looks the part.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know that he acted the part, but I think he seriously looked the part. I thought, right. You know, it's you know, he came right out of casting with it, and I think he looked it more than anybody else who's played the part. And, you know, as we record this, we're still a month and a half or slightly more than that away from First Steps coming out. And one of my biggest trepidations about that movie is I'm just not so sure about Pedro Pascal as Green Richards.
Yeah,
as
yeah.
Reed Richards. Did I say it?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. But I'll tell you, Jay Underwood as Johnny Storm and Rebecca Staub as Sue Storm, they are my Johnny and Sue. I mean, I think they're both perfect. To me, it's like they just stepped right out of the comics. I like them both. And I feel like that's really saying something in the case of Johnny Storm, because, you know, of course we have Chris Evans as Johnny Storm. I liked his performance of Johnny and everything, but did I feel like he was comic accurate? I don't think so. Whereas Jay Underwood, I liked, you know, his youthful enthusiasm and being a bit of a hothead and all that. Although I feel like they could have played that up a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I do think that Chris Evans had, you know, he nailed more of the quick tempered, hot headed impetuousness a bit better than Jay Underwood. But I don't know. Jay Underwood to me really did nail it though, as far as the look and the general feel. And then Rebecca Staub, I mean, she's just,
I think she was perfect.
Yeah, she's perfect. But I mean, she's gorgeous. She's smart. She's not like a cream puff or anything, but she's much more, to me, she was much more comic accurate to Sue. You know, she kind of, she is kind of more in the background, at least in the early adventures of the Fantastic Four. You know, she was kind of the shy one, you know, hence, you know, the development of her powers and that comment about her powers. So yeah, I liked her a lot, but then again, I mean, it doesn't take much to beat Jessica Alba, who is horribly miscast as Sue Storm, in my opinion. So
it's funny, but because I don't want to get into these other movies too much, but
right,
the 2015 one that came out, which was by all accounts just really, really bad. One of the reasons it was bad was the miscasting of Michael B. Jordan as Johnny Storm.
Right,
but. But
Kate Mara,
he was the best actor in the movie. So it's kind of a funny thing. It's like he gave the best acting performance, but he was just miscast in the role.
Right.
Was it Kate Mara?
It's a strange thing. Kate Mara was in that one. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Oh God. It's been, I tried to block most of that out, and I guess I'll have to watch it again.
Yeah. And before we, before we started to record this, I mentioned that, you know, again, as we record this, When this episode is posted, it's going to be just about when the movie First Steps comes out. After it comes out, if the four of us all get a chance to see it, we're going to do a review of that movie. And then I want to go back and do the Fantastic Four movie from 2005, I believe.
Five, yeah.
As well as the Silver Surfer one in 2007, and then the 2015 debacle. It should be interesting to kind of have a little bit of a retro review on those movies. But I don't want to go too far into depth in them, you know, with regard to them at this point just yet.
But I definitely want in on those two, the two.
I'm going to force you to watch the crap one.
I mean, I'll sit through it just, you know, out of pure curiosity, if nothing else. Like I said, I'm curious what the soundtrack might be like, because I can't think of a weirder combination of composers to do a Fantastic Four movie. That's probably the number one thing I'm looking forward to the most with First Steps, is that it's Michael Giacchino. And
I want to stop you for a moment, because I think what I want to do is I want to rate this one. And then I want to give each of us a chance to say, based upon what we've seen, what we've heard, whatever, what we anticipate for First Steps.
Right.
So I'm going to interrupt you to keep you from having to repeat yourself. With regard to this one, I can't in good faith tell you that it's a good movie. But I can tell you that there's things about it that I enjoyed. Primarily was the fact that it tried to stay pretty true to the story of the Fantastic Four, and that the acting performances were all pretty earnest for the most part. And I thought, you know, they really put their best foot forward as well as they could. And again, I would love to see this cleaned up and presented in a way where it's going to be a little bit more visually appealing, a little bit more audio appealing, and maybe the whole experience would be more appealing then. I don't know that that's ever going to happen, but I would love to see it. Overall, again, I can't say it's a good movie, but I don't think it's a out-and-out bad movie. So I think it's got to get a Jaws 3 rating as far as I'm concerned.
So for me, it was I'm in the same place. I'm Jaws 3, but I want to be clear. There's two different experiences I had with this, and I have to put that doomed documentary into the whole equation with this whole thing. When I look at the film itself, it's a Jaws 3 for every reason I stated on this as far as where some of my issues were. But I think there were some sequences in it that were Jaws 2 for me. I actually, there were things that I really enjoyed about this film, and I think that's why the sequences where they went awry bothered me so much, because there's potential here that I just really like. But when you watch the documentary and you put the two together, and so I'm separating this, my ratings, Jaws 3, let's hold on to that piece. I do have to say, for anybody listening to this, if you can watch Doomed and watch this together, I think there's a Jaws 2 experience there.
Yeah.
In putting all of that together. So I want to separate that as its own category, because it's not really fair to the film discussion. But my rating for the film's Jaws 3, do yourself a favor and pair those together, because it's intriguing to then go back and take a look at this film with knowing what you know from that documentary. There's a cool experience to be had here that I don't think you can say very, very often. If you're any kind of a film fan, do yourself a favor and do that, because it's cool.
I'm also going to go a Jaws 3, which is hard for me because I really like this movie a lot. And I mean, I mean very highly like this movie. But, you know, in all fairness, you know, Jaws 2 to me falls into that realm of I can watch it a lot. You know, I can rewatch it, you know, pretty often. I can't say I can rewatch this movie pretty often. This is one of those where it's like, it's got to be every few years I'll think about it. And it's been a while since I've watched, I'll dig it out and watch. Oh yeah. And, you know, as Sean said, I mean, there's a lot to like about it. There is a lot that I like about this movie. Unfortunately, you know, it has all the things that hold it back, you know, the budgetary things and the fact that, you know, they were under such a time crunch and they couldn't refine it. They couldn't fine tune it, that sort of thing. And then there are entire swaths of the movie that I just don't like, unfortunately. I really like the actor that plays Victor. I think he's great as Victor until he gets in the costume. Once he's Dr. Doom, I think, I got to be perfectly honest, I think he kind of sucks. Now, the costume's great. He looks great in the costume. He's just hamming it up and chewing the scenery to a ridiculous... He becomes a very cartoony villain, and not in a good way. So that really holds it back. And then again, I feel like they muddied it a little bit too much with trying to... They were being very ambitious, which I respect, but at the same time, there's a point of being over ambitious. And story-wise, they were just trying to throw too much in too fast. They were trying to do, you know, the overall Fantastic Four all in one movie. And it's like there's things you've got to put on the back burner and let them simmer and hope that maybe you'll get a sequel or two down the road that you can, you know, flesh those things out. Alicia being a big one. And again, I think they would have been better served to just concentrate on just one villain, Dr. Doom. But by throwing in the jeweler, I think that was a mistake for so many reasons. For one, I think he kind of sucked. I think it just, I all the scenes with him, those are the parts of the movie I really don't care for, that I feel like I'm kind of suffering through those parts. And, you know, if you can't get the rights to the character you actually want to do, then don't do it. And making him this weird amalgam just didn't work. I didn't understand that decision and that whole portion of it. I think they were, if they ever do go back in, you know, and get the ability to go back in and tinker with it and try to make improvements, I think probably the biggest improvement they could do is just excise that stuff right out. Of course, that would cut the runtime of the movie down drastically, but that could be a good thing too. But overall, as Sean said, I think paired with the documentary, I think you're looking much more at a Jaws 2 type of experience, because I learned a lot of things about the, you know, by watching the documentary that I didn't know. And I thought I knew pretty much the whole story with this movie. But the documentary gives a different perspective on it. And it's a heartbreaking perspective, because, I mean, these people... they weren't trying to make a turkey, you know, they weren't trying to make something ridiculous. Their hearts were in it. They thought they were making a real movie and trying to make a really good movie. So I give them real props for that, because I don't think it's bad. It just, unfortunately, it's a victim of, you know, of circumstance and budgetary restrictions and that sort of thing. But I still enjoy watching it. And also, I think it's important to note that in many, many ways, this is really like the first Marvel movie. Because up to this point, we hadn't really gotten anything that tried to be terribly ambitious. I mean, you know, we had the Hulk on TV and the Spider-Man movies, and, you know, I think Doctor Strange is probably best forgotten. So this, in a lot of ways, was kind of a trailblazer, and I think it deserves a little bit more respect in that aspect too. And probably another really big reason that it, you know, it really deserves to get an official release and an official recognition from Marvel.
All right, my turn. I tried to like it. It just reminded me too much of The Room. You guys seen The Room?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me it was okay. The acting, I know you guys liked it. I didn't. I thought that, yeah, and based on what you said about them not being able to alter the script and the limited time frame, because frankly, if it was a proper set, it was a proper shoot, then they'd look at the dailies and go, no, this isn't going to work. But to be honest, the guy that played the thing, the guy that played Ben, he reminded me of a cross between Thomas Hayden Church and the guy that played Gus, the creepy guy from Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. He just looked like it just didn't fit. His dialogue was horrible. The Thing's dialogue was horrible. There are times where Reed, it was almost a staccato William Shatner. Dr. Doom, Scott, you said everything that needs to be said about Dr. Doom. It was just ridiculous. The jeweler, it reminded me of like an elderly mutant Joe Walsh. So I just couldn't for the life of me understand why this was in there. And just some of the silliness. I mean, they take a blood test and, oh, we can see that our DNA is altered. I'm like, you can't see that in a blood test. Like, I get it. I wrote the script in 6 days. So, and then Johnny outraces a laser. I'm like, okay. What? And then they're flying into space with a minimum of what, 9 G's, and Johnny's not buckled in. I'm like, okay, this is just silly. But like I said, I think if they would have had the opportunity to watch the dailies more, to have the monitors, to be able to go back and look at this, they could have approached it and say, look, and then you would have taken that script and butchered it. And you would have said, no, this isn't going to work. I mean, you really needed somebody like, I hate to say it, but you needed someone like an Ed Norton in the movie, who's just going to be a script Nazi, who's going to take over the whole thing and rewrite the whole, you know, everything to his approval. And then he'll irritate everyone in the entire set. But, you know, it would at least get done. Obviously, that wasn't going to happen here. And watching the documentary, I mean, you understand it. And what was really sad was, I don't know, I kind of felt that, kind of felt the actors were a little naive in thinking that this movie that had no budget whatsoever was ever going to make it and not just going to be strictly straight to video. And the fact that it wasn't straight to video is sad. I mean, I agree. It needs to be released. Just everyone can see it. I mean, everybody should be able to see the Room. You can't. You can get it on YouTube. Everybody should be able to see the Star Wars Holiday Special, as terrible as that is, just to say you can, just to be able to experience it. And, you know, and I agree, combined with the Doomed documentary, which I'm going to watch that again, I think, after this. But the Doomed – well, no, I'm going to watch the rest of this Ranger game because we're only down by 2 runs. But, plan on watching that. But put those together, yeah, it would be a Jaws 2 experience. I wouldn't rate this as low as The Room because that's the worst movie ever made. I would say Jaws 3 would be appropriate. I didn't really enjoy it. I will watch it again. Just, you know, maybe a second viewing will give me a better take on it. But I just, like I said, I think had they had a second take at some of these scenes and a second, you know, rewrite of some of this dialogue and then recast Ben, recast Alicia, get rid of the jeweler altogether, tell cult to dial it down, then I think it would have been a little bit better of a movie, even with that budget. And I mean, I'm taking into account, I don't, you know, I want to go into the special effects, but you know, just taking in those factors into account, I'd say Jaws 3.
As I mentioned, let's give our thoughts as to the upcoming First Steps movie. At this point, you know, I think we've all seen the trailer at least. Again, I question the casting of Pedro Pascal. He does not cry out Reed Richards to me. But, you know, I am usually willing to sit and wait and pass judgment after I've actually seen it, because there have been casting decisions that I've questioned in the past and then found out that, you know, that they were right. I didn't think Robert Downey Jr. was going to make a great Tony Stark, and I think I was mistaken on that one. So there's no reason for me not to sit and wait. The special effects in the trailer look to be awesome. I like the fact that we're getting a Galactus the way he was in the comics, or at least it appears that we're going to get that. I like the fact that we have Herbie the Robot in this. I thought I got a kick out of that. And I thought the Thing looked really good. So I'm optimistic. I'm not going to say that I'm just ready to sign off that I think it's going to be great or anything like that, but I'm optimistic that I'm going to get a movie that I'm going to enjoy. I am often decrying the internet for the fact that people seem to think everything has to be the best ever or the worst ever, and that there's no in between. This may not be the best ever. It may just be good. This may not be the worst ever. It may just be bad. I don't know what it's going to be, but I'm optimistic that it probably will be good, and I'm looking forward to seeing it, and I'm keeping an open mind, and that's kind of where I am on First Steps right now. In whatever order you guys would like to go, what do you think?
I like the retro-futuristic setting. That piece has me cautiously optimistic that this might be something that I'm really going to dig, if that plays into it in the way that I think could make this film really cool, where I think the setting might be a character and might give some extra credit to some of the things that are your concerns, you know, as you know, some of the stuff that you're talking about, as far as casting choices and things. The trailer, seeing Galactus in the trailer has me very excited to see Galactus in film, which I did not think. I love Galactus in comics. I like the way he's being, you know, he's in some of the best stories that he's been used in. I think he's an intriguing character when done right. The way that that film looked, at least what they, we don't see a ton of Galactus, but I saw enough that has me really excited about that. But I will say, if there's one thing that has me going, it's the gadgets and the retro setting. If they lean into that in the way, because it's a parallel world, in the way that I'm hoping they do, this could be a really fun ride. And I'm fingers crossed that this could be a unique film from it. But that's kind of where I'm cautiously optimistic for it.
Okay, I'll go. I'm optimistic. I haven't seen a Marvel movie in the theater in a while. We didn't see Captain America. My wife and I just watched it the other night. It's all right. Thunderbolts, I think, is out in the theaters now. Yeah, I'll probably wait till Disney Plus. I mean, it looks interesting. And I think the after credits, because I cheated, and it references.
I don't know what's in the after credits. Don't give it away.
Okay, won't say anything. But no, looking at it, I am kind of skeptical about Pedro Pascal. Really skeptical about Ruth from Ozark as the Silver Surfer. But the appearance of Galactus, and if they do it right, I mean, I thought that cloud in The Rise of the Silver Surfer was just lazy. I mean, you don't need to have, if you're going to do it, you're not going to do it like Suicide Squad or that second Suicide Squad where they had, was it Starro? Mm-hmm. And they had an actual giant Starro, and it was like, that's the most ridiculous thing in the history of humanity, and it worked. I don't want to see Galactus with the purple trunks. Put some pants on him. So don't do original, what was that, Fantastic Four 49. Don't do your 48. Don't do that. But no, it looks, I really like the retro aspect to it. I mean, I keep looking at all that thinking, you know, you keep it, that was the, to me, that was the sweet spot of the Fantastic Four when I was a kid. I remember buying like trade paper, or the equivalent of trade paperbacks back when I was a kid, and just devouring that stuff just because it was fascinating. And if it just kept, these guys were one of my favorites, and I thought that the 05, 06 movies were good. I didn't love them, but they came close. But I don't think they've really, you know, gotten to the point where they, you know, show me the Fantastic Four that I want. And that's selfish and subjective, but it hasn't quite gotten there yet. And I'm hoping this one does. I mean, that one from 2015 certainly didn't. I mean, the closest you're going to get is the cartoons with Herbie, and that's, you know, come on. But no, it's something that I'm looking forward to it. I mean, I'm pretty sure that and Superman are probably the only two movies this summer I'm going to see in the theater. So I hope it lives up to the expectations.
I'm pretty excited for this one. I'll definitely go see it when it comes out in the theater and everything. But from the moment that it was announced and they started to trickle out, you know, details about who was working on it and everything, the thing that had me the most excited about it from the get-go is still the thing that I'm most excited about for it, which is Michael Giacchino scoring it. He's one of my favorite composers, you know, modern composers, and one of my absolute favorite soundtracks by him. Actually, my favorite soundtrack by him and one of my favorite soundtracks overall is Tomorrowland. And seeing as how Tomorrowland has a very similar vibe by what it looks like this Fantastic Four movie setting is, I'm expecting basically Tomorrowland 2 in the score. Beyond that, I'm trying to remain optimistic about it. I mean, I definitely want to see it and everything. I was very, very excited by both the teaser and the original trailer that we got. But unfortunately, the more I keep hearing about the movie, it has got me to a point now where I'm actively closing my ears and going, la, 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 when people start giving details, because I've started to hear some things that have made me nervous about it. So I want to go in with an open mind. I want to go in. I want to enjoy it. More than anything, I want it to fit in the Marvel universe, you know, the cinematic universe. I want it to hopefully start to course correct a bit the Marvel cinematic universe. But I also, you know, Chris talked about being selfish. I want it to feel like my Fantastic Four, and my Fantastic Four is the John Byrne era Fantastic Four, which, you know, everybody has their own, you know, gets their own mileage on these things. But to me, John Byrne's Fantastic Four is the Fantastic Four in their purest distilled form. And that's all I really want, is I want it to feel faithful to that. And it visually, it seems like it's going to, for a lot of, you know, for much of the film. I have the same trepidation about Pedro Pascal. I like the guy, but I'm sick of seeing him. And I don't look at him and think, yeah, that's the guy that should play the smartest man in the world. I just know he's, you know, that rugged thug from, you know, from The Mandalorian and from the zombie show, you know, that sort of thing. And I don't see him as the brainy type, if you know what I mean. Sorry, Pedro. Sue makes me a little nervous because it seems like they might be doing the whole girl boss thing again. And I thought Marvel was starting to learn their lesson and get away from that shit. So I'm not sure about that. The guy playing Johnny, he looks like he could be doing all right. He was annoying as hell in Stranger Things, but he kind of looks like he might be fitting this role pretty good. And then I love how the thing looks visually, but I wish they had gotten Michael Chiklis back to do the voice, because he nailed the thing as far as I'm concerned, voice-wise. He's the only one that has sounded like it. Unless they're going to do an 11th hour tinkering with the thing's voice and he's not going to sound like he sounds in the trailer, because the trailers and the teaser, because in the trailer and the teaser, he sounds kind of wussy for Ben Grimm, you know, for the thing. And I'm still surprised that, you know, here we are. What is this now? This will be our fifth Fantastic Four movie, has nobody ever gone back and looked at what Stan Lee himself had to say about Ben Grimm? Because he based Ben Grimm on Jimmy Durante. So why the hell doesn't he sound like Jimmy Durante? I mean, I'm not expecting the thing to go cha-cha-cha-cha, but you know, at the same rate, he should sound like that, gruff and made of rock, or you know, just with a gravelly voice. And of all the guys that did it, I think Chiklis did it the best. So I'm a little bit disappointed in that. I hope that maybe they do go in and decide at the, you know, at the last minute to tinker with his voice and make him sound a little bit more like what I think we all think Ben Grimm should sound like as the thing. But beyond that, we'll see. The only other real big trepidation I've got about it is, it's funny, there's something I really want to see, but I'm also really nervous I'm going to get it. So I have this theory that this feeling I've had since the very, I think it was the teaser, it was either the teaser or the first trailer, I forget, but there was a moment where somebody asked Reed, they say something like, "Can you save us?" I think that's what they ask him. And he just turns around, he has this look on his face, and he says, "I don't know." I think, you know what scene I'm talking about? Have you seen this in the trailers? And based on, well, I know Paul hasn't seen the Thunderbolt, so I don't want to spoil anything, but just based on other things, I have this feeling like they're going to fail. Like they can't save their world. And that's leading towards other things, because we know that one of the projects coming down the road is Secret Wars. And if they're going to do it like the most modern Marvel Comics version of Secret Wars, it was where different Marvel universes, kind of like Marvel's version of Crisis on Infinite Earths. I think that's where we're headed. So I think that's really cool and really interesting. But do you want the Fantastic Four to fail in their very first movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
That so, is one like of the things that gives me some trepidation as well. Yeah. And I've had that same impression.
So
that they're going to fail. Their world is going to get consumed by Galactus, and somehow they're going to escape to the regular Marvel Universe.
Right. And I don't know how I feel about that, because I simultaneously think it's really cool, but I think it also kind of shits on the Fantastic Four, and I don't want that to happen.
Let me give you the comparison that I've come up with in my mind to that forces me to keep an open mind. I think one of the best made and one of the best Marvel MCU movies is Infinity War.
Oh, yeah.
That ended with them failing. And, you know, it required that you saw the next movie, but it was awesome. So I think, you know, it can be done is what I know. So that's what's keeping me optimistic, is because I know it can be done.
But it also wasn't the very first adventure of any of those heroes. We had seen all of those heroes triumph in other adventures, you know, their own standalone movies, whatever the case may be. You know, Doctor Strange defeated Dormammu, and Captain Marvel defeated whoever, and all those things. So we'd seen them all as heroes triumphing over, in their own respective adventures. And in the case of the Avengers, we'd seen them do it twice. And so by the time they failed in Infinity War, it had that much more impact, because we didn't, those of us that don't necessarily, read comics and familiar with that, Joe Strait didn't see it coming. And so it was like an Empire Strikes Back moment for, the movie going public. I don't know that you could get away with doing that with the Fantastic Four in this movie, because again, it's their very first adventure. So,
we're going to have to see how their adventures play out, though. Maybe they're going to have some triumphs in the movie that are going to make you say, okay, I get it. They are heroic. They are resourceful. But this was just too big of a threat for them. And if they do that the way we suspect, and who knows, they could be giving us a total curveball on this. But if they do that, then doesn't it set up Galactus as the next version of Thanos to be the big bad? you know, the Fantastic Four was unable to defeat them on their own, and now, you know, defeat him on their own rather, and now, you know, the MCU, whatever number you want to give that world, they're facing that universe's version of Galactus, and the odds are looking overwhelmingly against them because the Fantastic Four wasn't able to defeat him. There's something to be said for that, but again, that would require you and me to wait for an additional movie after this is over in order to get satisfaction and closure on it.
Right.
So there is the chance of being walking out of this one and being left with the feeling of, huh, I didn't get it all yet. But right. I'm willing to do that. I had no problem with it with Infinity War. I know people did. I remember some of the people who are not comic fans were like, wait a minute, that's, you know, for, they were angry that they lost, and they were angry that it was just presupposed that they're going to spend money to go see the next movie. That's the criticism I heard on that. And you know what? If that's the case on this one, yeah, too bad. You know, it's just as long as I get a good movie, I'm willing to deal with that.
Well, that's a good point that you make, because I do recall that there have been Marvel Cinematic, you know, universe movies that I've seen where on the first watch, I didn't think that much of them, but then because of things that happened later on, it gave me a new perspective on those movies, and then I end up appreciating them a lot more. So yeah, they might be playing a bit of a long game with this particular movie, and I'd be okay with that. I just hope that there's enough goodwill left out there with the general movie-going audience towards the MCU that they would give it that space if that turns out to be what's going on. And I don't know, because, man, I see a lot of hate these days on the MCU, and I don't get it. I mean, I know they've had a couple rough movies, but I'm still invested. I still enjoy the hell out of them for the most part. There's only been one or two where I was like, yeah, that was kind of a stinker. But for the most part, I still really dig them. And if you haven't seen Thunderbolts, Paul, you need to see it. I thought it was really good.
I fully intend to. We just haven't had the right opportunity to go.
I'll echo the recommendation for Thunderbolts. It really surprised me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Tina's on board to go see it, too, because people we know who saw it and recommended it to her and aren't necessarily comic book fans. So that has her more intrigued. You know, I'm hoping for something similar to a Guardians of the Galaxy experience.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I'll see when I see it. But in the meanwhile, thank you guys for coming on. I appreciate you making the time tonight. And thank you everybody for listening. And we'll be back in 2 weeks. And I don't know if in 2 weeks we're going to have Fantastic Four First Steps, or if somehow this is going to come out after we've already done Fantastic Four First Steps. But whatever the case may be, we'll be back to do that one together. So we'll see you then. Bye-bye.
In recent years, people have been talking a lot about the Fantastic Four movie, understandably so, because we're living in peak superhero movies. You spoke with me before where you called it a good little film. And we've spoken at length about it. What's some lessons that you think current blockbusters could learn from your Fantastic Four movie?
I think it is to put the money on the screen. There's so much money going into overhead, to redecorating the producer's office. I'm making up, but you know what I mean. There's money that's being spent not on the screen.
You were also supposed to be working on a Spider-Man movie. Now, you were taking meetings with Stan Lee on this. How closely did you and Stan work together?
We didn't work that much together. I met several times with Stan. He's a good guy, and I enjoyed talking with him, and I got some of his ideas and so forth, and basically the concepts behind it.
I kind of think that if Spider-Man had come to pass and Fantastic Four had been released, the landscape now would be radically different, and there would be this Roger Corman footprint on this genre. Is that something that you've thought about?
I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but it is true. I was there with the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man before this type of film was dominating the box office the way it was.